featuring interviews and commentary from Animal Rights Zone, the online social network for humans who seek justice for other animals. You can find us on the web at www.arzone.net. I'm your host, Carolyn Bailey. Today's episode features special guest Brad King. Today, Brad and I will also be joined by AR Zone admin Tim Geyer. Brad is the founder of Farm Animal Rescue Australia, a new sanctuary in Queensland, Australia. The individuals cared for at the sanctuary have been rescued from the animal agricultural industry, some having been part of the horrors of concentrated animal feeding operations. Farm Animal Rescue's new 55-acre base of operations just north of Brisbane includes a 45-acre sanctuary, 8 acres of native rainforest, plans for an education centre, cabins, campgrounds and office space for Farm Animal Rescue staff members. Farm Animal Rescue will not only be taking in and caring for numerous neglected and so-called used-up individuals, but will also campaign against other animals being used as commodities at all. Hi Brad, thanks for sharing your time with us today and welcome to AR Zone.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's I'm very aware that you've had so many of my animal rights heroes on this program. It's a real honour to be part of this.
Thanks, Brad. I imagine you have a lot of news to share with us today about the sanctuary in general and also about the open day yesterday. Would you like to begin by telling us a little bit about the event from yesterday and also speak about what motivated you to create Farm Animal Rescue Australia?
Yeah, sure. Well, the open days are things that we try to have at least once a month at the moment. We'd like to increase the frequency of those as time goes on. But really it comes to the core of why we exist as an organisation, and that's really because people need to come here and they need to meet and experience farm animals, because we think that society in general has labelled farm animals as unthinking, stupid creatures that really have nothing going on other than sitting around and getting fat for us. And it's incredibly important to us that we get through that myth and that people get to understand just how amazing and intelligent and busy these creatures are. And I think more than anything, even with the relatively small number of animals we have on the property right now, it's just incredible how important they think that their daily duties are and how much they're actually involved in as we sort of go from day to day. So the open days are very, very important because it gives people that one-on-one contact. I think it's great for vegans and people who are already animal rights activists to sort of energize what they do outside of the farm, because it connects them with the whole root of the cause. So I think it's very effective from that perspective. And, of course, it's also great because we always get a fairly liberal dash of people who are not really part of animal rights and may not be vegan, who actually come along and get to look at animals in a very different way to, as I say, what they're used to society telling them animals are all about. So these are incredibly important to us. And the good thing about the open days is we have more people coming every time. We are currently dealing with today with what we're going to do about our car park, because we managed to overflow it yesterday, so that was great. The open days just are really core to what we're about, which is education.
That's fantastic, Brad. I think that's a pretty good problem to have, overflowing the car park on an open day. Brad, can you speak a little bit about what some of the hurdles might have been that you faced during this first year?
You know, I think that we're about to hit them now. Really, it's not been a difficult ride so far, because the property that we moved on to here had some existing structures. We have volunteer accommodation, which is currently fully occupied. So we had some infrastructure. We're just getting to the point right now, though, where, believe it or not, in a year where it has done nothing but rain in Queensland, we're about to run out of water. It is quite a hurdle on a property like this, and we're about to run out of our barn space as well. So our big things moving forward are going to be sort of fairly basic infrastructure things, because they're what's limiting our growth at this point. And I think it's also interesting to look at that from the perspective of what we talk a lot about, the environmental damage that animal agriculture does. I'm sorry, that's just one of the piglets. And it's really incredible once you start working with these animals and you see just quite how much water is involved in keeping them the way they need to be kept, and quite how much manure comes out of the other end of them. And you sort of populate that up to the thousands of animals that you find on some of these intensive farms, and it gives you a much better feel of just quite how much environmental damage comes out of all of that.
I think it's a real issue, isn't it?
Well, it is, and even down to things like again with a fairly small number of animals on the property right now, just things like what we do with the used bedding and with simply the manure, especially with pigs. For us, it's becoming something we really have to think about. So any suggestion that these facilities that have thousands of animals and not in a hell of an environmental mess is purely wishful thinking.
Yeah, I agree with you absolutely. You mentioned the piglets, Brad. Yesterday's open day, which I believe was titled Picnic at the Sanctuary, yes. was in honour of four adorable new residents who moved in a couple of weeks ago. I think their names are Holly, Heather, Howard and Thomas.
Very good.
Could you please tell us how they're doing? I know that they had some respiratory problems at first. Are health problems common in individuals that you rescue?
Every single one so far. Every animal that's come through the door has been, with the exception actually of the rooster and duck, every other animal has been sick when it arrived. There's always a lot of veterinary care at the upfront. Now we don't know for certain where these piglets came from. They did sort of arrive in the middle of the night in a very surreptitious manner. But we do know from the fact that their tails have been quite roughly cut off, and the fact that they were covered in feces, that more than likely have come from a factory farm somewhere. And of course, respiratory problems in pigs on factory farms are quite the opposite of unusual, because of the fact that the air that they breathe tends to be dreadfully awful and stale. It's very difficult this time of year for a lot of the pig farms to keep the animals warm enough, so that they're often cold. And of course, just the very fact that probably 2 or 3 weeks ago they would have been taken away from their mothers is also a terrible shock to their system as well. And is likely to do that. So yes, they did arrive with breathing problems. They had a lot of mucus. They had dreadfully runny noses, to the point that they were literally hanging their heads over the edge of the bedding that we gave them, and it was just oozing out of them. So they were quite away. But as we found with every single animal, all they need is a little bit of care and a little bit of support, and they heal themselves really fast. So right now they're all doing incredibly well.
That's wonderful. So they were about 6 to 8 weeks old when they first came into your care, is that right?
5 weeks, we think.
My goodness. So, and it's normal for piglets of that age to suffer with all sorts of health problems simply because of the way that they're raised as commodities.
Completely. And as we know, these intensive production systems work on the basis of acceptable loss. So different areas of industry will have different standards, but they all expect a percentage of their animals to die in the process, because it's actually cheaper for them to accept the acceptable losses than to actually provide care that would ensure that they all lived.
It's terrible, isn't it? At what age normally would these pigs have been slaughtered if they hadn't been rescued?
Well, it really depends on what they would be used for. If you're talking things like baby back ribs, for example, around about 3 to 4 months. Generally, bacon type products, hams and that sort of thing, anywhere 6 to 9 months. And then, of course, there's the true disasters of the industry, which are the breeding sows, who will pump out litter after litter for 3 or 4 years, and then be turned into small goods.
It's a terrible situation, isn't it?
Yes, because and I think especially with pigs, not belittling what any of the animals and the other animals suffer through at all, but with the pigs, of course, they are so intelligent, they are so clever, they are so curious, they are so active all of the time, and they feel, I think, possibly more intensely than the other animals, just the effects of the imprisonment that they have. And they certainly seem more aware of the fact that they're behind bars, perhaps, than some of the animals do. I mean, obviously, we have our little four pens. It's a nice large enclosure for them. But they're very, very interested in the fencing that's around the pen, and they're very interested in what's on the other side.
You know, what you're doing, obviously, is really remarkable. You mentioned, Brad, that Holly, Heather and the other pigs that you talked about arrived in the middle of the night. Mm-hmm. I guess that when you say rescue, people might think that you or your staff sneak into the sorts of places where huge numbers of pigs or chickens are confined in order to liberate them. Is that what you do? And if not, how do the individuals at the sanctuary usually come into your care?
No, that's not what we do. Now, having said that, I have absolutely no problem with people who do choose to do that. I think that they're a part of our movement, and if that's how they feel that they can best help animals, then we certainly don't criticize anybody for doing that. Our position really is that we're a more effective organization if we are working within the law. So we do everything that we can to do that. We do try to talk to government bodies about things that they should be doing to make the world a better place for animals. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later on. But, you know, obviously right from day one, we've had government departments with permits and things all over us, and they do watch us very closely. And for the benefit of the animals that we have here, and for the benefit of the good that we hope that we'll be able to do in the future, we keep ourselves very clean and very, very much work within the law.
That's great. Thanks, Brad.
Brad, Ronnie Lee can't be here tonight in the podcast, but we have something that's become known as the Ronnie question that Ronnie has been asking every guest in our podcast. So I'm going to ask it in his absence. And the question is, what first spurred you to become involved in advocating for other animals? And when did you become vegan? And how are those two things connected?
They're absolutely completely connected. I've really been vegetarian ever since I was able to make my own meals, and I was actually a vegetarian for 20 years. And in the whole time that I was vegetarian, I just always felt that animal issues really weren't relevant to me, because I didn't feel that I was a part of any part of cruelty or things that they're not. And so I really just chose to eat my vegetarian food and didn't look at or try to work out what was going on in industry, as it were. And that all changed actually it's about 10 years I've been vegan now. But about 10 years ago, when I was living in Miami in Florida, we rescued a dog that had come out of a puppy mill. And this was really the first time that I'd lived with an animal. And I realized pretty soon after we rescued him that this dog was actually having nightmares at night. And that kind of freaked me out, because nothing that I'd ever understood about animals was in any way suggesting that they were capable of even doing that. So that sort of made me think about things, and it actually made me have another look at animal agriculture, because strangely, the first thing that I did when that happened was think, well, maybe this happens to farm animals as well. So of course, I really started to look then at how these industries worked, and of course, as you are, I was completely horrified, and almost immediately went vegan. And then my really big thing, though, became that I was really rather outraged, because I'd been vegetarian for 20 years. I had therefore had a view about the appropriate use of animals in our society. But in 20 years, nobody had ever confronted me with the reality of what really goes on in animal agriculture, so that I could take that next step. Which is why ever since then, I've been involved in quite aggressive vegan outreach. I actually ran a table in Miami Beach for 6 years every Saturday night. There's a main sort of shopping and restaurant boulevard there, So we had a video table running every Saturday night for all the tourists and all the residents that were along there, and had just the most awesome response to it in terms of people really looking at this and saying, well, actually, this isn't right, and people actually reacting to what we were showing to them. But, of course, the most important thing is that I'm now trying to do everything that I can so that people who would make the right choice and who would react appropriately to this information are getting it, because I'm still just so sad that for 20 years nobody forced me to look at it.
When you say that no one forced you to look at it, what how do you see? I mean, is that what you're trying to do with your sanctuary now? Is sort of confronting people with that reality?
Oh, completely. This sanctuary is about the animals that we can't save. It's not about the ones that we have. So our big thing is education. It's getting as many people as we can here to meet and better understand the complex relationships that these animals have with each other and with their environment, about the fact that they're also busy, that they take their responsibilities very, very seriously. We've got a family of sheep on the property, and I could just talk for weeks about the mother of the lambs and what she does for them and just the care that she takes and how she trains them. So that's certainly one side of it. But the other side is that we take what we know here, we take what we learn here, and we do take that out to the community. So we do have video tables running in Brisbane and the Gold Coast from time to time. And we are working in a number of areas with government, trying to get them to accept that the laws and the regulations that they are saying apply in Australian agriculture actually don't. And what's actually happening is that the government is part of the lie about the way that animals are treated in Australia.
I wanted to ask you a question about the contact visits, Brad. I know that you've kind of already covered this, but I think that some sanctuaries are criticised unfairly for this sometimes. So I thought I'd go ahead and ask the question and give you an opportunity to respond anyway. Some sanctuaries, particularly in the US, don't allow the public to interact with their residents. You've mm-hmm. spoken today about the importance of education, and you do allow animal contact sessions at Farm Animal Rescue, as well as having plans to provide cabins and campgrounds for overnight visits. Could you please explain a little bit more on what your thoughts on this are and why you did decide to encourage visitors and allow them to closely interact with the residents?
I think there's two things with that. The first is that as I say, you know, we're not about the animals that we've rescued, we're about the animals that we can't. So getting that understanding out there is absolutely our number one priority. And I think that people experiencing and understanding these animals better is a very, very important part of that. The other side of it, however, is that we have some animals here who like to socialise with people, and we have others that don't. And the ones that don't like to socialise with people don't. We don't put them in position when they have to. So we know of the animals that we have, which ones like to be around people, and they're the ones we have contact sessions with. And the ones who are afraid or have had bad experiences, then they just get to be watched from a distance. So I think you really need to balance up the two. But you know, there's no point us trying to rescue hundreds and hundreds of animals and say we're making a big difference, because the difference is in changing societal views and a better understanding of exactly what we're doing to these animals. It's really not just about however many animals we can get onto the property.
Absolutely, I agree.
Just to follow up on that, would you say then that the people who visit your sanctuary or who learn about your sanctuary from, you know, online or however they hear about it, are they going to be confused about what your mission is? I mean, are they going to come away with any idea that you're keeping animals for human enjoyment or human pleasure or anything like that?
It's always difficult to understand what's going on in people's heads, isn't it? And I think that even with the best of intentions, there's always going to be an element who might get the wrong end of it. I think all that I can say is that when you come near any of our animal enclosures, what you're confronted with is literature and posters and information about animal agriculture and how it works. What we do is we talk about how amazing these animals are, the things that they do, and the effort that they put into keeping themselves safe and looking after their families. I think all I can say is that we do the best so that people understand what the property is for. We make a big deal of the fact that we're not here for the animals that are on the property. We're here for the animals that we can't save. Again, the educational aspect is just so important, and we are so very specific about the animals that people are to keep away from because they don't want to be around with people. While some people may take that view, it's absolutely not our intention. I don't believe it's what happens here.
From an operational standpoint, and obviously I don't need, I'm not asking about the particulars, but in general, where do you get the funding for the operation? I mean, it's 55 acres, and you've mentioned some of the hurdles that you face. Can you talk about how you raise funds and what, how much effort that requires, and where you get volunteers from, and whether or not you've got paid staff, and those sort of operational aspects of the sanctuary.
Yeah, well, of course, for exposure, because again, we think people being able to come here and experience animals for themselves is important. So we have located ourselves really quite close to a city, which happens to be Brisbane. It gives us the advantage of also being near some fairly large holiday destinations. So that gives us the opportunity in future to actually be able to bring more people to the property. What that's meant, of course, is the property is certainly more expensive than it would be if we located well away from a major urban centre. So at this point in time, I still work 4 days a week outside of the farm. We've, as far as volunteers are concerned, we've been absolutely overwhelmed by the support that we have from people who are well open to volunteering. We're lucky to have additional accommodation units on the property, so we have been able to provide free accommodation in return for the people who volunteer, and that's been absolutely critical because as many of our current supporters will know, with many of the animals we've had in, because they've been so sick when they've arrived, 24-hour care has been a big part of what we've had to do. So having people here on the property 24 hours a day is a huge thing. We pay no salaries. I myself don't earn a salary. It's all pretty much everything that comes in really goes straight to the animals, or in some cases water, like I'm going to have to buy today. but that's sort of really how all that ends of things works. Now our primary funding at this time really comes from two areas. One is that every one of our animals is sponsored. So we actually sponsor animals by name. So we give people the opportunity of actually having an animal here on the property that they know by name, that we acknowledge has been sponsored by them, and they basically pay a monthly rate for that, which is something that we've calculated based on standard sort of vet costs, bedding, feed, and all of that sort of thing. Those people are able to come and visit the animal that they're sponsored any time that they want. They're also able to bring their friends whenever they want, and we'll give them a tour of the facility and explain what we're all about and explain animal agriculture issues to them. So that really is sort of our primary area of sort of standard monthly fundraising. Our biggest event is actually just coming up in September and October, and that is something that we've duplicated that already happens in the US, which is called the Walk for Farm Animals. So we're having Walk for Farm Animals in Sydney and Brisbane this year in September and October. And the reason why I like this event so much is firstly, it is a sponsored walk. So the idea is that you pay a sponsorship fee to be part of it, and then you get people to sponsor you on the walk. But what we do is we just walk around these capital cities with a huge Walk for Farm Animals banner, handing out why vegan literature on the way. And it's a really sort of low-key, fun and enjoyable way to get people to turn around and say, huh, they're walking for farm animals. It really is a way to get a very different response from people who normally wouldn't be receptive to what we have to say, but when they see 60 people walking down the street all saying we're walking for farm animals, it tends to have an impact on those that we wouldn't normally be able to reach. But of course, the other side of it is that it's also a very good fundraiser for us, and we're really hoping this year that it will help us to build some additional barns.
Brad, how would those who are listening to this podcast be able to help you at the sanctuary or to contribute in some other way?
Probably the thing that I find most difficult about this is asking for money and trying to thank people for, because you know the volunteers that we have come through here are completely amazing people, and we feel so undeserving of what they do for us. It's really the thing that I struggle with more than just about anything else. So fundamentally, the sanctuary only exists really because of three reasons. One is because we've had such incredible support from people in terms of what we're doing, and just the good thoughts and the well wishes that we get have just been overwhelming. So that's been absolutely awesome to have. We've also had absolutely great success with our sponsorship program. So our sponsors are absolutely critical to the continuing success of the sanctuary, and we're so grateful to all the sponsors that have come forward. Now, as I said, we have some big projects that we need to start up with. We certainly need to sort out our water supply, and before we can bring many more animals onto the property, we're going to have to significantly upgrade our barn superstructure. So anybody who feels that they'd like to assist with any of that, we're happy for people to come along to volunteer on the property if they have building skills and things like that. And we're also very grateful for anybody who feels that they can spare a little bit of their hard-earned salary by going to our website at www.farmanimalrescue.org.au. There's a donation tab actually right on the front page there. We're also very happy to take any donations that people would like to send us that are specific. So if there's something specifically that you'd like your donation to go to, we're happy to accommodate that as well.
That's great, Brad. We'll make sure that we put the website and the details on the podcast when we post it as well.
You're very kind.
You talked about being involved in outreach for quite some time in Miami. But when I listen to what you've said, and we've talked to a couple of other people that are involved in sanctuary work as well on some other podcasts and chats that we've had in AR Zone, and is this the kind of work that just anybody can do? You know, can anybody decide one day, hey, I think I'm going to open up a sanctuary for farm animals or for rescued monkeys or for wild free living animals? Is this the kind of work that anybody could do, or did you have some sort of background that equips you to do this sort of work? From the technical day to day sort of running the business side of it. I know it's not a business, but it still has to be run like one.
Absolutely, it has to be run like a business. Yeah, that is more true, I think, than many people realize. And I think the answer to your question broadly is yes and no. The truth is, at some level, farm animals are not exactly difficult to care for. They are to a great extent very much self-sustaining, providing you give them the things that they need to be self-sustaining on that basis. Now, so that really is the yes side of it. Now the no side of it is, however, that the information about how you manage these animals that's out there is really quite difficult, because most of the information that you'll find on places like the internet and so forth is really coming from industry. And we always have to remember that industry is about growing these animals as quickly as you can and getting them slaughtered. It's not about caring for and looking after animals and nursing them into later life. So where we think that it was appropriate for us to pull together an organization like this is really that my particular background is in three areas. So I have the experience just with being in outreach that I was doing with the Animal Rights Foundation of Florida in Miami and all of that end of things. I have some experience working with Farm Sanctuary in the United States. I think they're an absolutely awesome organization. Susie Foster, who's the National Shelter Director there, is one of my absolute heroes of the movement. I've learned so much from her about both the care of animals, but also managing people who are volunteering for you in the care of animals, and also the way that you manage veterinary people and all that sort of thing that are sort of roundabout and are crucial to you keeping these animals safe. Probably even one of the more important messages is the fact that what industry feeds these animals is not what they should be eating. Just about every animal that's in intensive agriculture is eating grains, which for the vast majority of farm animals is a completely inappropriate food source. So I think it incredibly, probably the greatest influence that I've had in terms of getting this right is understanding from looking at Farm Sanctuary and the work that they've done and what they've discovered, and really mapping that over here. So I think without that background, we'd be struggling to a great extent. Now, I also have about 30 years of business experience. I ran my own business in the US for about 8 years, and that I think also is absolutely crucial, because you really do need to understand the whole issues with managing staff, with setting up your admin, with permits, and really just understanding that you can't just keep rescuing, because you need to have the appropriate level of funding coming in at the other end. And in reality, if you don't manage these places like a business, then you will lose them, and then something awful is going to happen to your animals. So again, and I know it's interesting, because I know Susie will give this same answer, and they actually run a course every year on running your own farm sanctuary, which again is really helpful, and it's a course that I've done. But it's really interesting that what you come out of that with is, well, yes, running a farm sanctuary is great and it's very rewarding. However, you probably don't want to do it. And I think that's probably the message that comes out of the back of this to most people, is that you need to get 100% of this right. Because every time you don't get 100% right, something can die or something can go awry. So you need to have a good background behind you. You need to have some sanctuary experience. You need to understand about business management, and then there's a good chance that you'll take it forward. But you need to have a really, really good hard think about it before you do it. Because once you're responsible for 30 animals, you're responsible for them for life.
Yeah. Do you find that the government agencies that you have to interact with, or I don't know how much interaction you may have with the industries that these animals have been rescued from, but are they generally cooperative or antagonistic, or how would you characterize that part of the
Definitely never antagonistic, and it probably comes as two levels. I think when you're looking at local and federal governments, they seem to be far more aware that there is a movement going on, and people are starting to look at animal agriculture a little bit more differently. And to a great extent, they're treating organizations like ours as a bit of a learning experience, because I think that they understand that they're going to have to be dealing with people like us to a greater extent in the future. What we're finding with state government, though, is something really rather different. What we find with state government is that, and I've heard this from some of the other sanctuaries in other states, is that they hope that by not responding that we'll just go away. So when it comes to state government, we actually have some trouble getting responses from them to do things that we need to do. And that can be at two levels. One is that, obviously we talk to biosecurity a lot, because we are we're sometimes having to try to get animals across borders and so forth, and that can be very complicated. And as I say, we do have some issues with just them responding to us. I'm pretty sure the major pork producers don't have any trouble getting responses back from biosecurity organisations at all. But we've had some sort of issues in that regard. The other way we were coming up against government, of course, is that it's just going back to this, let's be real about what animal agriculture is. And our issue here really is that most of the states have adopted codes of conduct which have been centrally written by some of the federal government departments. And what most of the state legislation then says is that, this state has adopted this standard as our recommended guidelines for the way that animals should be treated. And that's how the law looks. So when you read the law on the face of it, you say, okay, well, actually, these standards aren't awfully bad. So this is obviously how animals are treated. And, you know, some people might choose to say, oh, we think that's okay. Whereas the reality is that these standards are very rarely enforced. Nobody really looks at them. And so what we've been doing is going into places like sow yards, and we've been saying, will this sow yard is failing to comply with the basic standards that have been set for these sorts of animals in these, 27 different places. And we'd like this inspected, and we'd like a response is the reality that these are actually unenforceable codes, or is the reality that you have some work to do because you're not keeping these things under control? Now, our first submission on this subject went in August last year. At this point, the response that we're still getting is that it's under review, which is really very disappointing because some of the points that we made were that in the middle of summer they have dairy calves who will generally be between 5 and 12 days in areas that have no cover. So they're out in the blazing sun all day. There's no water supply to them. These are absolute contraventions against codes that Queensland say that they've adopted. It doesn't take nearly 12 months to go and have a look and say, oh, look, there's no cover. So the same thing actually with the pigs at the market that we went to. Pigs, according to the standards, are required to have access to water at all times. There is no water at this facility. There's also no mechanism that's set up to allow water to be available to the pigs at this facility. So again, this doesn't require a 12 months investigation to say that, that these pigs don't have access to water because it's clear and obvious. Right now the game we seem to be playing with state government is that they're hoping that if they just don't respond to us, that we'll go away.
Well, I guess we expect government inefficiencies when we go get our driver license, but you'd think that the agencies that are tasked with protecting the lives of other animals would actually do their jobs. It's kind of disheartening to know that they don't.
Oh, but the reality is these organizations are set up to support animal agriculture. It is the reality of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
And welfare, I think they see, is a necessary part of that because there is some consumer demand to ensure that animals are well looked after. But, we truly believe that before we can take the movement a terribly long way, we have to get to the point where we're able to have honest conversations with people. Because I'm sure that any animal activist has had the experience of talking to people about the reasons why we believe animal agriculture is inappropriate, and part of that being the way that animals are treated. And people that you talk to simply don't believe you because it's not what their government tell you is how animal agriculture actually works. So we really believe that that getting the truth out there and getting acknowledgement of the way that these industries really work is absolutely crucial to us trying to move forward to a real and factual conversation with society in general as to the appropriateness of there being an animal agriculture industry at all.
Brad, I've heard many Australians claim that other animals will always be eaten by humans, and the best we can ever hope for is that we can treat them kindly as we commodify and oppress them for our pleasure. How do you feel about statements like that, and do you think that working for better treatment in places like sale yards might send a message that you accept that other animals are commodities, but that we should just treat them a little kinder as we're using them?
I really don't believe that at all, Carolyn. I think the reason why we need to be involved in what might be seen as sort of welfare conversations as well as the abolitionist kind of conversations is because really pushing on welfare does two things. One is that it makes all of these issues that we have about the way that animal agriculture works more public. So people become more aware of exactly what's going on in these industries. And I think the example that I'd use there is, of course, the Animals Australia experience of the live exports media publicity and all of that produce, and the substantial decrease in the amount of animal product that was eaten over the following weeks, because it actually made people think about where their food was coming from, about the treatment of the animals that were involved in that process. Now, it didn't sustain, of course, and levels are pretty much gone back to where they were, but a big part of our job is to just keep these issues and keep the awareness of animal treatment in the media, and welfare is actually a good way to do that. So I don't see the welfare discussion as the objective at all. I see it as a useful way to get there. I think the other thing that we need to be aware of is that the reality is that any successes that we have in getting improved welfare into these organizations ultimately will have an impact on price. And I think we have to be realistic about the fact that one of the issues that we have when we're talking to people about the possibility of veganism is that we're seen as an expensive option, and we're seen as something that most people really don't have access to. Now, I like many other people, would say that's possibly not true. However, if you're a new vegan and what you're trying to do is basically replicate a standard meat meal with what's available as vegan products, then we know that when we're going into stores and buying things like the meat replacement products, then generally the price comparison would not be in our favor. So we have to be aware that the price does actually matter in our society, and that anything that we can do in terms of welfare that increases production costs, which makes that product in the stores more expensive, is going to make what we have a more feasible option for people to look at, because the price discrepancy isn't so great. I actually go way back. Way back, I started out in economics, and price really does become incredibly important. And if you're struggling day to day, and you're one of these people who is having to think about what you're spending all the time, then really it's a very difficult discussion for us to come along and say, well, look, but you really need to understand these animal issues, and you need to think about your health and animals, because all that they're trying to do is survive. So I really believe that getting into the whole price thing is incredibly important.
I absolutely agree with you on the price thing, Brad. I think it is very important. And like you say, for somebody that's struggling to survive day after day, it's a difficult situation. And yeah, like you say, I have a teenage son, and he eats a lot of the type of food that you were talking about, and I know that can be quite expensive. So yeah.
Well, and the realistic of it is, you can still go into McDonald's and you can buy a 99-cent burger. You come to any of our establishments that might sell burgers, and you're paying $8 or $9. Now, it's much better product. Food's much better for you. However, if you're living on pennies with a family of five, it's just, we need to be doing everything that we can to make this an easier jump for people, I think.
Yeah, I think it's a very important issue that often gets overlooked. Brad, our final question for you today is about your approach to advocacy as opposed to some other approaches. Do you feel that talking about animal rights alone is as effective as it could be? What I mean is, do you think that talking about the philosophy of animal rights, for example, rather than talking about animal protection or the well-being of other animals, connects people with the lives of other animals?
Yes, I do, and I think this is basically coming to what our core is. Rather than us talking about the fact that these animals suffer the way they do in intensive environments and all that sort of thing, although we do talk about that, and we do make it clear that that's what's going on, I think what's far more compelling is communicating to people that these animals are actually much more complex than we really think they are. Something that we've already had happen here in the early days was an experience that we had with some of the sheep, where we had a lamb brought onto the property who was very close to death. She'd had a fatal worm load, and was apparently on her way to be euthanized by the vet, and the lady who had her on the property just decided to bring her here instead. We were able to nurse her back to health, but it took about 10 days all in all to do that. Now, what we ultimately found out was that there were other sheep on this property that had also had very near fatal worm loads. So we did manage to extract a few more, and one of those that we extracted was the mother of the lamb, and it was really quite incredible, because the day that we brought the mother to the property, at that point the lamb still couldn't walk, so we just put the lamb down on the ground and let the mother come up, and she walked up to her about 3 or 4 times and sort of made a signal for her to follow her. This is after 10 days, remember, so a fair bit of time had passed. Tried to get her to follow her, couldn't understand why the lamb wasn't following her, and then sort of in the end of it just sort of walked off. And, of course, what we did was we immediately sort of fell back to all of the things that animal agriculture will tell us about ewes abandoning their lambs and all this sort of thing. We thought, you know, well, that's it, we've got an orphan lamb now, this is going to be so much more difficult. But the incredible thing was that that night, this lamb did not sleep one second. All that we heard all night was bang, bang, crash, because all she was doing was trying to stand up. So for 12 hours straight, she just tried to stand up, tried to stand up, tried to stand up. The next morning when we opened the barn where the mother was, she came running out of the barn, came running down to the house where the lamb was, stood under the house and barred and barred and barred. They barred at each other for about 2 hours. All of a sudden, Lily, who was the lamb, managed to stand up. So we took her outside with the sheep, and while they were sort of meeting each other and everything and getting on, I was saying, well, look, I think what we'll do is we'll keep the lamb in the house just one more night, because I just want to make sure that she's all good before we put her out in the barn with all of the others. And then ultimately that was completely taken out of my hands, because at 3:30 that afternoon, the mother just the lamb back up to the barn, and they just sat up there themselves, and so we had no say in it, because mother had taken control, and even though those lambs are now 10, 11 months old, that mother is still showing them where to eat. She's still taking them to have a mix of wet and dry pasture. She's absolutely still doing her job, which is caring for these lambs, keeping them safe, and making sure that they eat right, and all that sort of thing that we think is exclusive to the human world. This is why, you know, what we're talking about is completely and always will be about animal rights, because we have no right to take that functioning family unit and split it up because we want to wear a different sort of sweater next week.
That's a remarkable story. Thank you for sharing it with us. We totally appreciate your time today, Brad. I know that you're really busy, particularly after yesterday. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you and hear about the very important work that you and all the others are doing out at Farm Animal Rescue. Before we go, though, is there anything that we haven't covered yet that you'd like to mention to our listeners?
Oh, Carolyn, you know, I could talk for hours, and that would become very dull in the end of it. But you know, I think, again, the most important message is that the what we try to do, and I know that at the end of the day, there are lots of different people within the animal rights community, and we all have slightly different views of the best way to do things, and I think what we try to do very much is try to look at what we have in common with other people in the movement, as opposed to try to concentrate on the areas where we're different. And you know, I think generally, I think that's something that the movement needs to think about regularly. Our numbers are growing. We can be an incredible force, but in order to be an incredible force, I think we all have to look at what it is about each other that we agree with and how we can move forward, and accept that you know, my way of advocacy might be different to your way of advocacy, but if we're both doing that, then that's probably the collective greatest. So I think that's probably where I'd sort of like to leave on. What we very much want to be is part of a community of animal rights activists. We want to be here as a resource. We want animal rights activists to be able to think they can bring people here and they can further educate them on just how amazing these animals are and about how horribly we treat them. And, you know, if for example, people are not that keen on the way that we're trying to work with government to bring about changes, then that's just absolutely cool. I really would like other people to go and do things that they think are important and that they think are the way to do things, because, you know, I'll be just as supportive of that. But I think we all need to understand that this movement is a big tent, and the more people we have doing things in different ways, the more successful we'll be.
I think that's wonderful advice, Brad. I think that comes down to respect for each other as well.
Yeah, but, and as I said, our motto is that you know, in everything that we do, we always try to say, you know, when we're trying to make a decision, the question always needs to be what's best for the animals.
Absolutely, I agree. We completely appreciate your visit to AR Zone today, Brad, and everything that you're doing out there. Thank you very much.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for the invitation. It's been a complete pleasure.
Thank you for listening to AR Zone. Please visit us online at www.arzone.net and look for us on iTunes.